I said, so most of you came back, so that's awesome. I didn't run most of you out, so glad to be with you. So yesterday, I gave an illustration about distinctives, and I asked my dad to stand, and I asked Paul to stand. And my dad said, why do you got to point out my gray hair? Why can't you say something good about your dad in your sermon? So I'm going to ask my dad to stand up again. So Dad, if you could stand up. Come on, let's go ahead and stand up. And so, you know, the truth is, I have a lot of people in my life that I admire, but my dad's my hero. And so if you want to know the way that I am, you can look at him. So let's give a round of applause for John Belanti. Got to be on the good side because I've charged all my expenses to his room. So, Tom, thanks for that. That's awesome. If you've got a Bible, we are going to head today to the Gospel of John. John chapter 13. Yesterday, I handed out those study guides. If you didn't get one or you want another one, those are there. And I don't want to bring those home, so you can grab a couple extra if you want that. We have been talking about this revolution, this love revolution. A revolution being a sudden, extreme, or a complete change in the way that people live, in the way that we do life. I think, as I mentioned yesterday, that it is time to rethink things. Revolutions happen when the old way no longer works, when things need to be rethought and redone. So last summer, I bought an appliance. I think it was a dishwasher, and because our dishwasher exploded. And we bought a new dishwasher, and one of the incentives was a $100 rebate on this dishwasher that we bought. So bought it, had it installed, had the rebate on my desk, and I kind of forgot about it. And it expired by a few days, and I thought, oh, I got to get that in. So I rolled the dice, and I filled it out, and I sent it in anyway. And I got a letter back that said, you know, sir, sorry, you missed the date. You don't get your $100. You're out of luck. Sorry, it's things to be you. And that did not endear me to that company. I'm like, it's only been a couple days. If you wanna retain customers, go the extra mile, right? So I contrast that to the Apple company. So all the electronic devices I have are Apple, iPad, iPhone, MacBook, everything I use is Apple. And one of the reasons I use Apple products is because of their customer service. Like, they have the most incredible customer service of any company that I deal with. A couple of years ago, my battery died on my laptop, and those batteries are not cheap. AppleCare expired, all the warranties expired, everything expired. I brought it in to the Apple store, and they said, yep, your battery's died, it needs to be replaced. I said, fine, replace it. It said, it'll take a couple hours, so I went, shopped, came back. They gave me my computer, and they said, here you go. I said, what's it going to cost me? They said, oh, no, sir, we took care of it, no problem, have a nice day. Free battery. I'm like, see, that's what I'm talking about. That is why I buy Apple products. It is a distinctive of their company. They have great customer service, at least in my experience. Maybe you have a different experience, and I don't want to hear it because, like, I don't want to wreck it. So just leave it alone. If you had a bad experience, keep it to yourself because everything that I've had has been incredible, right? As a Christian, as the Christian church gathered together, we have some distinctives. We have distinctive doctrine, and we have distinctive behavior, one of which is love. If we don't have distinctives, we melt into ambiguity. Now, unfortunately, sometimes our distinctive of love gets sacrificed on the altar of being right. Sometimes what we believe actually gets negated or trumped by how we behave. My wife and I, when we first began ministry, we worked in a church in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I was the youth pastor, and my wife was the church secretary. So we worked together. That was kind of cool, very small office. My wife worked for the senior pastor of that church, and my wife and I told you years ago, we had a miscarriage, and so it was right around that time. She was working in the church office. We had a miscarriage, and after a few weeks of kind of healing up from her surgery, she went back to work, and she was sitting at the secretary's desk, and one of the young women in our church that had just had a baby walked in with her new baby, And, you know, that's hard, right? If you've ever been through that, that's hard. And so my wife was trying to be a champ, and she held the baby, and she thought that was, you know, she held the baby and gave it back, and then the woman left. And she was kind of sitting at the desk, you know, tears a little bit, because it's hard, right? If you've been through it, you know it's hard. Well, she was sitting at her desk, not working, because she was kind of mourning and crying. And the senior pastor walked out of his office, and he looked at her, and he said, "It's been a month. Aren't you over it yet?" Right? Ask her. I'm not lying. So, things like that baffle me, right? Because you're looking at me, you're thinking, how could anyone say that? Because love is meant to be demonstrated, not dissected, not debated, which is why I believe that the battle cry of the love revolution is this. What does love ask of me right now? Like right now, in this moment. Because if you're like me, I'm guilty often of using 20-pound theological words, talk a big game. But there are so many that use these 20-pound theological words but actually never do anything. The Christian faith is filled often with armchair amateur theologians sitting behind keyboards pontificating, yet never really expressing this love that we've talked about. I was online a few years ago, and there was a big controversy in the Christian world. I don't know how much you follow, but there was a big controversy with a great organization called World Vision. Maybe you're familiar with World Vision, a Christian philanthropy organization. They feed children. Great organization. They do a lot of great work around the world. But a few years ago, maybe 2014 was the date. I can't remember exactly, but World Vision made a very confusing announcement. The president, Rich Stearns, made an announcement. This was during the time when gay marriage was being passed in our country. And World Vision made this announcement. They said that World Vision was not going to take a stance on the divisive issue of same-sex marriage. But then they went on to say, but we will, however, from this day forward, hire couples in same-sex monogamous relationships. Well, that was confusing to the Christian community for a lot of reasons. And as a result, there was a response. And the response was immediate and prolific. People in the blogosphere lit the internet up with questions and arguments and confusions and went on the offensive, and big-name Christian leaders asked for people to boycott World Vision, which basically meant now a starving child in Africa was not going to get resources because of a policy decision made in Seattle, Washington. It was a big deal, a big controversy, and I followed this and I watched it. Well, 4 days later, Rich Stearns reversed his decision. And he said, "We made a big mistake. We should never have done that. We're going to stick to our traditional views of Christian marriage." And as a result, the response again was immediate and prolific from the other side of the argument. Now, today I'm not here to talk about sex. That's not the point of this sermon. What I want to talk about is I was on the website of Christianity Today, who published the article. Great, well done article. But at the bottom, where the comment feeds are. Have you ever read the comment feeds for blog posts? Fascinating. So I was on the comment feeds, and most people on the comment feeds were Christians. And they were Christians attacking each other, saying the most vicious things about each other, about World Vision, about theology. And as I read these comment feeds, I was horrified. Because that is the image that the world around us is seeing. I sat at my computer table in mourning. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. It's good to stand for what we believe to be truth. It's another thing to be a jerk about it. Jesus said that demonstrating love is the proof that you are one of his followers. This message, when I wrote it, is a tough one for me. Some messages that I write come easier than others. This one today came with a lot of blood, a lot of sweat, and a lot of tears. I don't get up here and say what I say, just to kind of stir the pot. I'm not really a pot stirrer. Like, I don't like to be controversial. I don't like to make people mad. I'm kind of a people pleaser. Like, I want people to like me. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Is there any other people pleasers out there? Be honest, because like but sometimes there are things that are so deep in my soul that I believe so strongly. And as I wrote this message, because I did write it, I don't download my sermons off the internet. Okay, I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into these things. And this message that I want to give today is very, very simple, and yet at the same time, debilitatingly complex, because the practice of it seems almost impossible. In the Gospel of John, chapter 13, Jesus is gathered with his disciples. This is what John writes. He writes, when he was gone, referring to Judas, when he was gone, Judas has left, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. Now, I want you to imagine this scene for a second. Jesus is with his disciples. He knows his time is drawing near. He knows he's going to be crucified. He knows he's going to die, and he knows he's going to resurrect from the grave. He knows he's going to be subject to torture. And so in the final days of his life on earth, he gathers his disciples to give them some final words of instruction. He asks them to continue the work that he began. Now, in this moment, as Jesus has gathered his disciples, he's actually following an ancient Jewish tradition. In Jewish culture and tradition in the time of Jesus, when someone was dying or knew they were going to die, they would be surrounded with their most intimate of friends, their family, and if they were a rabbi, their disciples. And they would give a speech. It would be like a departing speech. And in this speech, they would show concern for their family and their friends. They would offer words of comfort for those who were going to be left behind. And often there would be an exhortation to obey the law of scriptures. Often a dying rabbi would leave a deposit of their writings with their family and friends. And in some cases, they would actually pass their spirit on. Like, for example, Moses and Elijah did this respectively with Joshua and Elisha, right, in the Old Testament. So this would have been the moment in which Jesus would gather around his disciples and he would say to them, guys, this is what matters most. I'm going to leave you some final words, and this is what is the most important. This is what he says in verse 34. He says, a new command I give you. Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples, if you love one another. So as Jesus is giving this speech, he's actually offering them a command. The word that Jesus chooses to use in this passage is the Greek word entole. It means an authoritative direction. And so Jesus, as he's standing before his disciples, he's speaking with authority. And he says, here's the direction I want you to go with the rest of your life. I mean, think of all the things he could have said in that moment. He could have said, be true to the scriptures. He could have said, be faithful to the cause. What he says, I want you to agapeo each other. I want you to agape each other. I want you to love each other. The word agapeo means to have a strong, non-sexual love and affection for another person and their good as understood by God's moral character, especially characterized by a willing forfeiture of my own rights and privileges on behalf of another person. And so Jesus says to his disciples, here's the direction I want you to go. This is what I want you to do. I want you to love one another. Now he calls this a new command. Now, the command to love was nothing new. The command to love goes all the way back to the Levitical law. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, the Old Testament says you're supposed to love your neighbor. You're supposed to love each other. But what is new about this command is the dramatic sense in which they're supposed to love one another. Jesus says, love as I have loved you. Jesus just got done washing their feet. And you know who was in the crowd that day as he washed their feet? Judas. Judas was there, the one who was going to betray him. And Jesus says, just as I've washed your feet and just as I've washed Judas's feet, I want you to love one another. I want you to love one another so well that it actually becomes the defining characteristic of who you are. When people talk about you, when people talk about your church, when people talk about your faith, I want them to talk about the way that you love one another. Not your Bible knowledge, which is important. Not your church attendance, which is important. Not your volunteer experience, all that is good. Love will be the way in which the world will identify you. Now, unfortunately, as I've talked with many of you over the past days, too many faith communities walk in division and not love. I wonder what it would look like. What would the world look like? What would our faith look like if we chose to set aside our petty differences and focus on what matters most? Because for a love revolution to succeed, it will take followers of Jesus who will demonstrate their faith by loving their brothers and sisters with a deep love that keeps no record of wrongs. I'm convinced that the world around us is desperate for that kind of love. It's hungry for that kind of love. May we love each other so well that people can't help but ask, What is so different about you? There's something about you. We're not about winning arguments. We're about winning people. Because what's in us will flow out of us, right? Because sometimes we look good on the outside, but on the inside, it's a little different. I spent a lot of years as a youth pastor. I love being a youth pastor. I had no plans to be a senior pastor. God had different plans, but I worked with teenagers, and I loved it. We had a great youth group. And when I was youth pastoring, we would always start our youth evenings with like an icebreaker game. And I'd always come up with these creative ways to just have fun. So one day, I decided we're going to do a caramel apple eating contest. And so I had three caramel apples. They looked delicious. And I asked for three volunteers. Three volunteers came up. And I said, okay, here's a game. I've got three caramel apples. And the person that can eat these the fastest, the first person done, you win. All right, they got their apple. So on your mark, get set, go. And they took huge bites out of his apples because they want to win. But what they didn't know was it was a caramel-covered onion. That was awesome. You should have saw the looks on those kids' face when they bit into that bad boy. So let me ask you a question. What do people get when they bite into you? Maybe you need to let that sit for a second. Sometimes when I'm thirsty at our house and my wife's not looking, like I'll grab the milk jug and just kind of chug it real quick, put it back. One day I did that, grabbed it, chugged it, and it was totally spoiled. Just big gulp of. You ever chugged spoiled milk? That taste stays in your mouth forever. You're like, trying to get it out. It won't go away. There's another question. What taste are you leaving in the mouths of people? I know it's hard. We're at camp. We're supposed to be inspired. It's going to be a good time. But again, I said, I hope you walk away this week refreshed, encouraged, but also challenged. Because what's inside can often be deceiving based on what's on the outside. You ever had a tense moment, and in the heat of the moment, you say something, and you say, I can't believe I said that. That's not like me. I didn't mean to say that. Well, I say, you meant to say that because that's exactly what's inside of you, right? So I was with my family a couple years ago. We went to the Milwaukee Museum to see the pirates. They had this really cool pirate thing. And we went, and, you know, I got a boy, pirates are cool, and so we went and saw the pirates, and it was a great time. We had a good time, and I went down to the parking garage, and we got in the van. It was a good time. We saw the pirates, and it was awesome, and I got in the car, and my kids were in the back, and my wife's next to me, and I back up, and I wasn't paying attention. I slammed in the car behind me. Boom. And a word came out of my mouth. that I won't say because Ron and Tom will never have me back. And I said, oh, and my kids said, oh, Dad. Because if you got kids, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I realized there's some stuff in me. When the heat is turned up appropriately, it comes right out. Jesus said, proof, what matters most is what's actually living inside of you. He said, the world around you will know that you're my disciples. By the way, what's inside actually comes out. It will distinguish you from everybody else. If you move to the writings of the Apostle Paul actually prays what Jesus commands. In the book of Ephesians chapter 3, verse 17, Paul prays this prayer over the Ephesian church. He says this, "For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name. And I pray that out of his glorious riches, he may strengthen you with the power through his Holy Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have the power, together with all of the Lord's holy people, to grasp how wide and how long and how deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses all knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all of the fullness of God." In verse 17, Paul uses two words to describe the place of agape, or love in our lives. He says it's got to be rooted, which is an agricultural term, and established, which is an architectural term. So I want to bring these two texts together. I want to bring John and Ephesians together. So Paul says, "And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power." Jesus says, "A new command I give you, love one another. I'm commanding you to love one another." It's love demonstrated in action and defined by who God is. See, I think this, what we're talking about today, is a life and death issue. Because we're talking about the way that we treat people. We're talking about being representatives of Christ. And if you're like me, we tend to dehumanize people, right? So you're driving down the highway and some idiot cuts you off and you flip them off, right? Because it's not a person. It's a thing. It's that person that cut me off, or that annoying person at the grocery store. All these people that get on our nerves. I know how you feel because I've been there. Yet if we embrace Jesus and follow his way, our spiritual DNA begins to change. Now, of course, we're all still human. We all have issues. We all have tempers. But we bring those issues and challenges with us to our faith. But we're progressively working towards something. Because the truth is, if we can't get this one fundamental principle down, then the rest of our faith is built on a faulty foundation. I heard the story of a pastor of a very large church. One Sunday morning, he gets up in front of his church to give the sermon. He stands up and he says to his congregation, "Love one another." And he goes and he sits back down. People are kind of looking around like, what? So he gets back up, behind his Bible, and he says, "Love one another." He goes and he sits back down. People are looking around, you know, that nervous. No one's just looking around. So he gets back up again. "Love one another." He goes and he sits back down. And finally someone stood up and said, "I think he wants us to love each other." And then what happened went down in the history of this church. Someone from this side of the auditorium got up and walked all the way over to this side to a person sitting right there, and they said, "I know I've offended you, forgive me." And someone else got up and walked to the other side, and all of a sudden, this congregation that was wrestling with division and strife came together in a miraculous and wonderful way because they answered the question, what does love ask of me right now? Because the truth is, God is not on a truth quest. God is on a people quest. And yes, truth is important. But Jesus was not concerned about truth as much as he was about transformation. It's why Paul says, and I pray that you, all of us, that you would be rooted and established in love. Because we're all rooted in something and we're all established on something. Because what you're rooted in is what you actually become. I mean, think about it. What do roots do? He chose a very strategic word. What do roots do? They absorb and they anchor. The word the Bible uses to describe the product of our life is the word fruit. Our works are referred to as fruit. You cannot have fruit without a root, and whatever's in the root will be in the fruit. And if love is not in the root, all the fruit will be sickly. Then he uses an agricultural term, or an architectural term. He uses the term established. It refers to the foundation of a building. What you are built on determines the stability of what you're becoming. So what do foundations do? Well, it's the very thing that holds up the rest of the building. Your foundation determines what you have the potential of becoming. So for example, if our whole lives are built on acquiring more stuff, more toys, more money, more, and our sole purpose in life is to acquire more, could it be our foundation is greed? Others of us have had terrible things happen to us. We have. We've had horrible things happen to us, and it's changed our foundation for life. And some of us build our lives on a foundation of bitterness because we can't move past that thing. Adolf Hitler built on a foundation of hate. Jesus goes on to describe to the Pharisees. He says the Pharisees represented the religiously orthodox, they were the religiously orthodox thinkers of the day. The Pharisees stood on the right side of truth on every issue. Pharisees built on a foundation of truth, which was important. Yet, the Pharisees had the most difficult time loving the people that Jesus was making a part of his community. So imagine how shocked the Pharisees were when Jesus claimed confidently that the entire law is based on or summed up in the command to love. The unfortunate truth is sometimes our zeal for truth and the command to love has been at odds with truth in the evangelical world. And yet Jesus says, a new command I give you. Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love each other. When I gave this sermon series at our church, we built a campaign out of it. And after week four, this guy said to his wife, and his wife told me, so be careful what you tell your wife because they always come tell me. And this guy said to his wife, he said, yeah, I get it. Mike wants us to love people. Finally. As we did Love Revolution in our church, some incredible things began to happen. For instance, we have a life group that we require for anyone that wants to become a member of our church. So our life group is filled with new people, all new people to our church. And there was one woman in our church that was, she was dyslexic, she had a bunch of physical handicaps, and she really couldn't read, adult. And so she's sitting in our life group and she says, this book is great, but I can't read it. So someone else in the life group, who was also a new person, said, well, they didn't know each other. She said, oh, well, I'll come over to your house and read it to you. And someone else in the life group said, yeah, the day she can't do it, I'll come do it. And a root began to get established. During that Love Revolution campaign, we brought in a group called Feed My Starving Children. Feed My Starving Children is an organization out of Chicago that packs food for hungry kids. And they do this thing called Mobile Pack. And so you get your church together, and they come, you rent a warehouse, and they bring all the supplies, and you pack the food, right? So you pack the food, And then they ship it to countries, and they've got an incredible success rate. So we're planning this, and we're planning this event, and it's going to cost us $22,000 to do it, and we need 800 volunteers. I'm like, oh my gosh, I mean, how? So I told our staff, I said, you're crazy. We got to come up with another 22. We're in a building project right now. We've got to come up with $22,000 and 800 volunteers. You guys are out of your mind. The church will never respond to this. Well, we announced the project. The first thing that happened was someone who I have no idea who it was walked up and said, Mike, I'll give the first $11,000 to the $22,000. That's the first thing that happened. Crazy. The rest came in out of the blue. And then we did sign-ups. I'm like, oh, we gotta have 800 people come give up their Saturday to pack this food. And I'm like, Lord, please, 750, please. Well, when registration came around, 1,200 people registered, and we had to turn people away because so many people wanted to get involved because they grabbed onto this crazy principle that was started by Jesus in which he said, I want you to love each other. I want you to love each other, even if each other is someone living in a third world country way across the world. So what matters most? It's the proof that we really are who we say that we are. So I'm going to wrap this up in a moment. I'm going to ask Chris if he'll come back. And I want us to just take a moment. Right now, there's going to be no music for a second. Be completely quiet. We've got plenty of time. I want us to just take a moment of self-examination. We live in a very busy culture, and we never take time to just stop and look at ourselves. Let's take a moment and ask this question. How well am I loving? I'm not talking about your wife, because your husband, we're supposed to love them, right? I'm not talking about people you like. I'm talking about the world around us. How well, as the Christian church, are we loving? Let's just take a moment with the Lord. For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name. I pray that out of his glorious riches he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have the power, together with all the Lord's holy people, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. And to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. Amen.